This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and our show is called Main Street because we gather this time of day and talk about stuff that is of interest to our listeners and we think worth exploring a bit. And today we're going to talk about a topic that has been around our area for a long, long time, and we've been wrestling with it. And we're going to talk about it from a new perspective with producer Meg Luther Lindholm. She is the producer of Testimonies, which you can hear this Sunday at 5 p.m. Central on Prairie Public Presents across our radio network. The Testimonies program will be a conversation about the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls program. Thanks for joining us, Meg.
Thank you, Doug. I'm really happy to be here.
What's the idea behind your approach to a program that you're calling Testimonies?
So the basic idea is to bring in three people into the studio who all share something in common, either an experience or in the case of this particular episode, maybe an experience and a cultural background, to talk about an issue that they all have something to say about. But instead of asking, you know, basic questions of, you know, how did you come to be involved in this or why is this your interest or whatever the questions would be, what I do is I provide a series of word or phrase prompts that elicit their memories, their ideas, their personal connections to the topic. And I came up with it as a way to try to kind of do a deep dive more quickly into topics that aren't necessarily all that easy or comfortable to talk about, but that in many cases the guests really do want to talk about.
And what did you find out in this case?
Well, so in this first episode, I had been thinking a lot about the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls ever since the disappearance of Savannah Graywind. It was something I really hadn't known anything about prior, and then suddenly the issue blows up in the media, and I've always been really interested in tribal issues. I've tried whenever possible to drive out to the different reservations to do stories or interview people on different issues. And this seemed an opportunity to do more exploration of this problem with people who live here in Fargo and could come into the studio and have the conversation.
And the Savannah Graywind story was such a big story that it actually kept this issue out there for a little while. The media concentrated on it for a few weeks.
Yep.
But now it's time to look at it again.
Exactly. I find that is often the case, that the media will really play up an issue and then it just kind of fades away and we move on to other things. And that seems to be kind of the normal cycle of how the media works, and it's true on all levels of media, national, international, local. But right, I did want to keep this issue alive, and I felt that the guests really had a lot to say, and maybe there hadn't been as much chance to hear them speak so deeply and with so much so much that they had to say and to share. I just knew that was the case, and I wanted this first episode to focus on that issue.
Again, it's Testimonies. It airs this Sunday at 5 Central, a conversation about the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls program. Let's listen to an excerpt. They will introduce themselves, and you'll ask a question.
Hi, my name is Chelsea Snyder, and I'm an enrolled member of the MHA Nation. That's located on the Fort Berthold Reservation here in North Dakota. I'm also a mother to an amazing 7-year-old human being who I'm raising to be an empowered, intelligent, Indigenous woman. And I'm also the author of Lauren's Law, the first anti-human trafficking law in Indian country in U.S. history. And I just want to say thank you for having us today. And thank you for discussing this actual, real, visceral issue that we face, not just as Native Americans, but as a whole in the United States.
Don?
Hello, my name is Dr. Donald Warren. I'm a member of the Oglala Lakota tribe from Pine Ridge, South Dakota. I'm a family physician and also have training in public health, and I serve as the chair of the Department of Public Health at North Dakota State University. And at NDSU, we offer the only Master of Public Health program in the nation that has an American Indian focus. So our students can actually get a master's degree in American Indian health. And certainly one of the big public health challenges that we face and that does not get enough attention is missing and murdered Indigenous women. So this is a part of our curriculum to make sure that our students understand the policy issues as well as the public health implications when we have so many of our young women who are missing or murdered. So I agree with Chelsea. Thank you so much for putting some attention on this very important issue.
Whitney?
My name is Whitney Fear. I'm also a member of the Oglala Lakota Nation, the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. I'm a mom of twins. I'm a nurse, a graduate student, and I currently work with the homeless community in Fargo, Moorhead Metro Region, which is comprised of a large number of extremely vulnerable individuals, namely Native American women.
All right, so let's take a moment to go over the ground rules for the program. I'm going to say a word or phrase connected to the problem of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Jot down your thoughts. Then each of you will share what comes to mind from your own knowledge and experience. So, to get started, the first phrase I want you to think about is how each of you personally relate to the problem of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls.
I relate to the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls because I am an Indigenous woman, because I am raising an Indigenous woman, because this is an issue that does not get talked about openly and honestly. And I'm also involved because I understand the jurisdictional issues between local, state, federal, and tribal agencies that create a lack of sharing and a lack of knowledge just because of my prior work. But the main reason I'm involved with the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women is because I am one, my daughter is one, and our people throughout the United States deserve better.
Okay, thanks. Don, do you want to go next?
Sure, and I do appreciate the idea to include men in this discussion. And when I think about our traditional roles as men, certainly in Lakota but many other tribes, our role is to be a protector, not a perpetrator. And unfortunately, when we do see violence against women, when we see human trafficking, it's usually the men who are the perpetrators of this type of violence. So for me personally, just thinking about how I was raised in a family with very traditional Lakota people who understand the traditional roles of men in the family and how we are supposed to be protecting our families, protecting our children, protecting our women, when I see what happens in our communities, it's heartbreaking because it's really against our cultural belief systems. It's against our traditional belief systems. But I also have a 7-year-old daughter, and I don't find the current circumstances of bad policy and bad data for this particular issue acceptable. So I also feel a personal role in my work in public health and addressing data and policy to make sure that for the next generation we do a better job than what's happened in previous generations.
Whitney?
Well, I have it's kind of the same point of view as Chelsea. I'm a woman and I have a daughter. I have nieces. You know, the collectivism that is the tribal way of thinking is that all women and girls are my relatives. They're life bringers. They're sacred. They're my sisters. They're my mothers, grandmothers. So for us, we take it as seriously as if our own daughter was missing or our own sister was missing, because there's no separation of that. Like there is an individualistic society, which is kind of mainstream America, because when you practice true, you know, collectivism and honoring each other, there is no room for things like owning other human beings and using other human beings for your own gain. The people who do that, the perpetrators of these crimes, are not honoring themselves because they don't honor or value anything else.
Thank you. Moving on, the next prompt is search for the missing. So who would like to go first on this one? Whitney, do you want to take a shot at it?
Yeah, I can go first on this one. So immediately what comes to mind for me was the search for Savannah Graywind. I remember the family being on TV and saying that they had gotten a tip that Savannah may be at Buffalo State Park out by Glendon, which is the community that I live in. And I looked at my husband as we were watching the news, and I said, I have to go. And he said, I know. Be safe. Let me know what happens. And I get out there, and I couldn't believe there's no help. You know, there's no one. There's a half a dozen people. And I thought, that's all she's worth? You know, she's not. Man, I was so astounded. I couldn't believe that there wasn't more help. You know, everybody went out there to look. You know, I saw people still trudging around at quarter after 9 o'clock, you know. And from what I understand, the only reason that law enforcement showed up was to make sure everyone left the park by closing time. But I not one time saw them looking. And I'm not against law enforcement. My brother worked in law enforcement on the reservation for almost 10 years. And my grandfather was a highway patrolman and sheriff for 45 years. But, you know, I thought, I'm walking around and I'm thinking, how do you force the family into that choice that they have to be the ones looking? Because if this is going to turn tragic, why should someone have to find their own daughter like that? And what if, you know, in those cases where community members, like even with Olivia Lone Bear and Emily Bluebird and on Pine Ridge, what if they were still alive and they needed help? How are you supposed to get them out of these remote areas when the volunteers you have are not trained to do that? I mean, the state, you know, could mount this huge National Guard response for a protest in Western North Dakota, but couldn't, you know, spare a few people to look for a woman who is 7 months pregnant and missing. So, you know, for me, what comes to mind is, you know, we have to advocate for ourselves, and often we're using our own personal resources to help these families, help each other, because I think we inherently know if I'm ever in this situation, they'll come and they'll help me too. And you hope that that's not going to be the case. But when it just repeats itself and keeps happening, it's hard to imagine that you're not at risk somehow.
Thank you. Don, do you want to go next?
Sure. When I think about the search for the missing, I think about our systems and, of course, from a public health perspective, we have a lack of resources, a lack of attention, and a lack of data. When I think about the resources, quite often the argument we'll hear is that it is not a crime to be missing. But we're not talking about just the person who's missing. They're in danger if we don't know where they are. And there is certainly public health and potential for violent death as a result of being missing. We don't know what the circumstances are. So this isn't treated as the significant issue that it really is. And we certainly don't see resources put toward it. In Canada, they do a little bit better job than we do here in the United States. And of course, as Indigenous people, we did not draw the line between U.S. and Canada. And being here in North Dakota, we have relatives on both sides of that invisible border. But in Canada, they're at least taking a look at this. They have missing and murdered Aboriginal women national programming. We don't have the same type of federal focus. And when I think about the attention that's not given to this, there's almost a dehumanizing of Indigenous women. And I think Indigenous women have always been thought of as a commodity by this government and by the people who live here. And even looking at some of the racism coming out of our own president when he refers to Senator Warren and calling her Pocahontas, you know, she's one of our first missing murdered Indigenous women was Pocahontas. She was only 21 years old when she died. So there's just been a longstanding challenge of getting the resources and attention focused on this.
Thank you. Okay, Chelsea?
Well, when you say search for the missing, the first thing that pops into my mind and the first thing that I want to talk about is that the only reason that Savannah Graywind is getting the attention and this situation is getting the attention is because of the horrific circumstances of her death. It wasn't the search for her. It was how she died. And that's a big issue. When we talk about searching for our missing and murdered Indigenous women, let's take a look at what's going on with Olivia Lone Bear. I'm glad that this is getting attention and people are becoming involved. But the problem is not in the involvement later. It's in the first 48 hours. We know that in the first 48 hours, if we don't find our missing women and our people, anybody, regardless of race, the likelihood of them surviving is almost non-existent. So in those first 48 hours, where is the training for our law enforcement on the reservations? Where is the support from our state law enforcement and our federal law enforcement within those first 48 hours? When we're talking about Olivia, when we're talking about Savannah, what we're talking about are our community members. There are non-Indigenous people that are involved in the search, and there are non-Indigenous people out there that care. But who we need to care and who needs to train and who needs to offer that support and that infrastructure to actually make the impact for these community members who are going out and doing what law enforcement is supposed to do in the first 48 hours, we need those law enforcement officers there. We need people there to help us search for them so we can help them search for our missing women.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Meg Luther Lindholm, the producer of the excerpt you just listened to from Testimonies, a conversation about the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls program. You'll hear it on Prairie Public Presents this Sunday afternoon at 5 Central. Meg, after researching the program and producing it, what are the issues or the ideas that sort of jumped out at you about this?
Well, what I love about this program and this conversation is that and what I was really looking for and what I feel the three guests really provided was both their own personal connections to the issue. You know, for example, Whitney Fear works with homeless people at the homeless health clinic and deals with many Native American women who she says 100% of whom have been victims of sexual assault and violence. Mm. And that's one thing, you know, is to learn how high the statistics are in these types of crimes against Indigenous women. And also from Dr. Warren, you know, how much data we don't have about this problem. And from Chelsea, you know, talking about how the problems of lack of law enforcement and lack of actual prosecution of these crimes. One of the points that Chelsea makes is that only a little over half of the sexual assault crimes against Indigenous women ever actually get prosecuted. The cases get dropped at various stages along the way. Either there just isn't the appropriate evidence that's collected right after a crime happens. Women fail to report. People get away, you know, again, because there isn't enough law enforcement on the reservations. So for all kinds of reasons, many of these cases simply aren't prosecuted. But in addition to that sort of factual information that the guests communicate, there's also the sense of how each one lives with this issue and has lived with it, has grown up with it. If they grew up on a reservation, it was sort of surrounding them. And it's not acceptable, but it's in some ways kind of ingrained within the environment that many Indigenous people live in.
Well, you're talking about essentially a cultural divide here, at least in how a particular issue is dealt with. So, you know, we are from one culture. You were talking to three people from another. Did they provide some insight about how their own culture might affect this?
Only in the sense that I think it might have been Chelsea who said that many women just don't report. There's a sense of what's the point? Why would it matter? I might just get into more trouble if I did, and no one's really going to do anything. Or maybe the person has gotten away. Or for a variety of reasons, a lot of women are either afraid to speak up or just feel that it wouldn't make any difference to speak up. And so that, too, can play into this problem of cases never really going forward and having even the opportunity to be prosecuted.
And probably they would be going forward and prosecuted if more people were aware of them.
Right, right. And Whitney relates a personal experience that happened to her when she was a girl, and she went to a county fair with her aunt and uncle. And there were some men who were absolutely, you know, in some ways, it sounds like they were sort of terrorizing Whitney and her friend. And they holed up in a car. I guess the men were going to try to you know, come after them for something that didn't seem right and didn't seem good. They didn't really know what. But Whitney said, you know, she didn't even go and tell her uncle and aunt what had happened after the men finally went away, because she felt like her uncle would have gone after these guys and that he would have been the one put in jail if he had, you know, committed any sort of violence against them in anger for what they try to do to her. So there are lots of cases where children are just told, you know, be quiet, just stay out of trouble, don't go here or there, don't wear this kind of clothing. And there's such an atmosphere of fear. You know, all the mothers that I've interviewed who have daughters just speak of such fear around any potential danger or harm happening to their daughters.
So this program, Testimonies, will deal with a particular issue that affects the Native American culture and us as the larger one as well. Are there other ideas that you want to pursue with this approach?
Well, yes. I mean, the idea of doing a series called Testimonies rather than just one program was to take this approach and apply it to different situations and different issues. So, for example, and you know, my MO, my interest is always in talking to people who I feel we don't hear from enough directly in the mainstream media. We may read little snippets, or we may read policy issues around particular topics like incarceration or homelessness. But what about bringing in three people who are homeless to sit around the table and talk about that experience and what it's like to live without a home? Or three people who have experienced prison and can talk about what that experience was like? And again, each person coming at it from a different perspective, their own perspective, but still to have that longer conversation with people that we just don't really necessarily come in contact with or connect with in our day-to-day. And not just to keep it to those kinds of issues, but maybe it's also about something like parenting. Like, you know, I have a child who's about, you know, who's a tween, and you know, it terrifies me, the whole adolescent phase that we're going to go through for the next 7 years. And you know, so what about bringing in three parents who can talk about the difficulties and challenges of parenting teenagers? You know, I'd love to have that conversation.
Well, as an independent producer, you know, there's another challenge involved here, and that is supporting an idea like this. So how do you get testimonies funded, underwritten?
Yeah. Great question, and one I could really use some help with. We did get funding for this first episode from the North Dakota Humanities Council, I guess now called Humanities North Dakota, and I'm very grateful for their support. But we do not have funding to continue the project, and so I would very much appreciate anyone that would be interested in financially contributing to making more episodes of this project possible to contact Bill Thomas here at Prairie Public. And he's well aware of, you know, my making this ask. And it's one that I think it's a project he and I feel very strongly about, that it's really an important project, a good project, bringing in more voices that we don't necessarily hear from in our day-to-day. And so I would welcome any contributions to support this effort.
All right. The challenge has been made. Thank you, Meg Luther Lindholm. She's a producer of Testimonies, a conversation about the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls program. You can hear it on Prairie Public's radio network at 5 o'clock on Sunday. Of course, it streams all the time, and there will be a link online as well at prairiepublic.org. Thanks, Meg.
Oh, thank you, Doug.
Coming up on Main Street after the news, a discussion with Simon Wilson. He's the brand new executive director of the North Dakota Trade Office. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A former Burley County deputy faces drug and theft charges after methamphetamine and cell phones and evidence were stolen from the Metro Area Drug Task Force. Kerry Kropkowski was arrested on Tuesday night.
While at the residence, the sergeant discovered some evidence of a crime. The Burley County Sheriff's Department placed Kerry Kropkowski on leave immediately. We started an internal investigation, attempted to interview Kerry, and he resigned.
Sheriff Pat Heinert says Kropkowski was working patrol Saturday when he asked his supervisor for an extra hour of leave. That was granted, but he didn't show up for more than 3 hours. Heinert says the supervisor then went to Kropkowski's house. A search warrant was issued for the residence.
In his home, officers found numerous items, including methamphetamine, drug paraphernalia, and stolen cell phones.
1 pound of meth was found with a street value in excess of $10,000, as were 13 cell phones. Komorowski had been a member of the task force before being reassigned in December of 2017. He was arrested and taken to the Stutzman County Correctional Center. Heinert says the case has been turned over to the State Bureau of Criminal Investigation.
It is not easy for us to arrest one of our own, but it is important for our community to know that no matter the circumstances, we will be professional. We will make the hard decisions to arrest one of our own if they violate the state laws of North Dakota.
McLean County State's Attorney Ladd Erickson is prosecuting the case. After seeing years of development in unmanned aerial systems, new developments are budding in counter-UAS technology. Thomas Sawyer is president of Grand Skies Development Company.
We are talking about the detection of unmanned aircraft, or remotely piloted aircraft is probably the better way to describe them even, and then the ability to defeat them, either make them turn around and go home, make them come out of the sky in some fashion, or make them otherwise unable to continue whatever mission they were on.
Sawyer says the U.S. Department of Defense has been the main driver behind the effort. He says UAVs have quickly become a tool for opposition forces to use against the U.S. military.
Opposition forces, or, you know, people that we're fighting against, are using drones for nefarious activity, whether it's just to spy or to carry weapons. That's where a big chunk of the investment is. And there's also concerns of drug smuggling across the borders, you know, carrying illegal narcotics or other illicit materials fairly long distances.
Sawyer says counter-UAS technology is just the beginning. He says the effort goes beyond preventing forces from using drones against us.
There is a counter-UAS effort as well.
Sawyer says for every technology developed, some people will use it for good and some will use it for bad. He says we need to be prepared for both. And Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton wants more people answering the phone and responding to emails at the state's Driver and Vehicle Services Office. Dayton's supplemental budget proposal contains just over $7 million to hire an additional 63 employees. Calls and complaints have increased since last summer's rocky launch of the new vehicle licensing and registration system known as MNLARS. Public Safety Commissioner Mona Doman says more people are needed to improve customer service.
The current staffing level is not sufficient to handle the volume of calls coming into the department, which leads to Minnesotans not receiving the assistance that they need and that they deserve.
Some legislative Republicans question the need. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined in studio by Simon Wilson. He is the brand new executive director of the North Dakota Trade Office. Thanks for being with us, Simon.
Thanks, Doug. Pleasure to be here.
Well, tell us about how you got the job.
Well, it was a long process, but it's really one that I've really enjoyed the take to come through. This was really a search by the Commerce Department and the board to say we will look for somebody that really can help bring some value to our members here in North Dakota from an international perspective, have a lot of background in here, and really being a North Dakota a person, it's really somebody that they were looking for to say, how do we take this to the next level? And I'm proud to be here.
And you came to this job from the industry, really, the Titan Machinery. You were working there, right?
Exactly. I've been in the equipment business for more than 20 years. The last 5 years with the Titan Machinery and the very global nature of a company. So it's I'm proud to be able to bring my background into this, and been an ag boy, grew up on a farm ever since I can remember. So for me, being part of the ag business and what North Dakota brings, for me, it's a lot of fun.
Well, the North Dakota Trade Office is perched right on the edge of the state. It's located right here in Fargo. Tell us about what it does.
Well, the Trade Office really is an advocacy and an education group, and we have members from across the state of North Dakota and as well as business partners that our real focus is to help North Dakota companies, large and small, and help take their products, their services, take it to the rest of the world, be it Canada, Mexico, or lots of international partners over in Asia and Europe as well, too.
Well, we are a commodity-producing state. We export energy. We export lots of ag commodities. So, obviously, international trade is important to the state.
Absolutely. North Dakota produces more than it can use. The exports have continued to be growing from the energy perspective. That's a big key for us. But the ag perspective is we're one of the largest ag exporters in the U.S.
Well, give us a sense of how important it is to the state. Who are our major markets and what are we selling them?
The major markets, really, the number one major market is Canada, you know, and Mexico is right behind it. Those two countries combined, our NAFTA partners, combined for 87% of our exports.
Wow.
From the North Dakota Department. And it's a little more than $5 billion of exports a year that the great state of North Dakota does. So 87% is a lot of product that goes into the NAFTA partners.
So renegotiating NAFTA might make some people a little nervous?
Yeah, it's a little nervous. It's been one that there are a few issues that some of our members bring up and some of the things that we need. You know, it's a fairly old agreement. It's been around since 1994. And it's one that it needs probably some updating, but it's one where we're advocating and we're big, strong supporters that NAFTA remains and NAFTA is part of it here for the state of North Dakota and our customers in the ag and energy business. It's key for them.
Well, we have the longest undefended border in the world pretty much with Canada. It's another issue with Mexico. Are there any relationship problems that develop from that kind of rhetoric coming out of our capital?
Well, it's one where, you know, sometimes the rhetoric is there for a need, you know, and it's one where I think there's a need to ensure that everyone understands how important this is and you need to bring them to the table. And when you have everyone around the table, the conversation is what we advocate. You know, there's issues, I think, on both sides. I think Mexico and Canada are saying there are some things that they'd like to see changed as well. So we believe that's good. We believe the conversation is good. The rhetoric, we'll leave that to people in other areas to do. But for us, it's really important that that our members and our businesses here in North Dakota, that they're heard and that their issues are taken seriously when that negotiation is happening on the table.
Well, there's recently been rhetoric and some concern about our trade relationship with China, the talk of tariffs. It's the potential talk at this
yep.
point, although some have been imposed by China,
sure.
as I understand it. So give us a sense of where that puts you.
Well, being the new guy in the trade office from here, it's a fun time to come into it and be involved. But
fun time?
Well, for me, it's one where, you know, this is a challenge. There's a lot of rhetoric around. There's a lot of important issues that need to be discussed. And it's one where we're okay with some of the discussions and some of the needs. It is very disconcerting, though, to a lot of our producers from the ag input side all the way through to some of our manufacturing and exporters that deal heavily with this. You know, the China piece is, for us, it's a key customer of a lot of our end products. There's a lot of use from here. They've kind of thrown what we call the nuclear option back at us. From here, the soybean piece, the corn and soybean threat of a tariff really was there for kind of that, let's throw that at a certain individual and see, because we know how important that is to certain states. North Dakota, it's extremely important to us. But we understand the need to get them to the table and hopefully from now as quick as we can, because this is really driving uncertainty. And uncertainty for everyone doesn't do anyone any good.
Well, when you look at a political map, it seems like our adversaries are pretty politically sophisticated, pretty astute, because that soybean map is solid red.
Yeah. I think they had that kind of in their hip pocket for a while from this way. They understand what it means. They understand what it is. A lot of our partners and our members, especially in the federal side, are advocating for patience. That's difficult, you know, especially at this time when, you know, seeds are going to be going in the ground very soon and decisions need to be made that not only affect this year but affect next year's marketing of product, especially on the export side. It's that uncertainty that we need to get over, and we need to get it over quick.
So you're talking with the North Dakota Agriculture Department, I assume, about this and other issues?
Correct. We have a lot of links and a lot of communication both with the North Dakota Agriculture Department, the North Dakota Department of Commerce, as well as our commercial services and the Department of Commerce on the federal side. We feed a lot of information. There's a lot of two-way conversation that's going on, and really we're advocating for a quick get to the table and really see if we can hammer this out and move forward.
Well, North Dakota, as we've mentioned, is a commodity state. It relies heavily on ag commodities and the energy sector as well. Mm-hmm. Both of those have been impacted over the last few years, and ag prices have suffered. This timing doesn't seem very good for that.
No, and that's the other piece. You know, from our producers and from somebody who's grown up on the farm, you know, this has been a pretty tough time the last couple of years from here. And I'm not sure if timing is good or bad from here. In some ways, we are where we are now. So how do we get through this and get it through quickly, I think, is what we know our members are asking for. But then also we believe the rest of the producers and the people in the ag business. The energy side is a pretty dynamic game right now as well. Our ethanol companies here in North Dakota, they're really working to grow their business and to grow their exports. You know, we're having some conversations of some China opportunities. They've closed their border to the ethanol side effectively with some tariffs and things they've done. But we're working to see if we can help them and facilitate that and open that up.
Well, when you close a border, you can affect the price. Now, these are finite products. Only so much ethanol is mm-hmm. produced in the world, only so many bushels of soybeans. So maybe they find a new market, but there's a cost involved in that.
Exactly. And that's the challenge that comes with this is, you know, there's a lot of long-term established businesses and relationships that have been built up. And if all of a sudden these what we call arbitrary barriers get put in, a tariff or a tax of some sort, then that forces some of these relationships to move. And if China moves, let's say, to Brazil, one of the other larger producers of soybeans, there is a need, and they still have a huge need for importing soybeans. Therefore, the Brazilians and the downstream effect is we would have to go to new consumers and find new customers in other markets. But the logistics side of that, our products mainly go to the west now from North Dakota. Having to move them to the Gulf and to move into a South American or a South African market would add extra cost. And therefore, are we competitive? And those relationships take time to build. So it's a challenge, and it's one where there's been a lot of work to build these long-term relationships, and that's what our members are saying is, let's not wreck this with some arbitrary barriers from here. We've done this. Let's keep it and let's go forward.
Well, since China really opened its markets to international trade in the late 20th century, it's become huge. But China has been talked about as imposing unfair trade practices. Can you give us an example of what those might be?
Yeah, there's a lot of those things, and it's a great point because it's one that's not talked about a lot. But there are a lot of things that happen on this trade business, and for me, I've been involved in some of these, and then over the last couple of weeks with our members, just meeting with them and talking with them. There's a couple of things that are done that nobody talks about, and these are things like quarantines that the Chinese do at the ports, where they'll do a quarantine inspection, and they may hold that product for no reason other than they believe that there's something with it, and that will cause extra cost, time from here. Some of the same product would go straight through. Sometimes, depending on who it is and where it's going, they get held on. Some of their pieces, how they do their value-added tax, it's not consistent. So there's that inconsistency that for some people they might get taxed and some people they don't. All those costs get passed through to the customer, and then that's part of the total cost that our businesses and our exporters have to deal with and discuss in future deals and future opportunities as they work through.
Aside from the trade rhetoric on both sides of the Pacific here, does the World Trade Organization have a role to play?
Yeah, the World Trade Organization, it's real important. There's a lot of work that gets done, and there's a lot of pieces that come back. So a lot, especially for us, as we find some of these issues that come through, what the North Dakota Trade Office works with, we'll feed those back in through, and they'll go into the World Trade Office inspection program. And if there's any unfair practices, they kind of get addressed and get worked with. Hopefully, a lot of times they don't go through that because it's a long process. We like to get our federal partners involved and the U.S. Trade Representative And the Department of Commerce does a pretty good job of really getting involved and trying to fix those things when we hear it. But again, there's a lot of these that go on, China and a lot of other countries, unfortunately.
Well, when I was a kid, made in Japan had a quality connotation. Now it doesn't anymore. Mm-hmm. There are high-quality products from Japan. You can't walk into a store anywhere in the United States and not see made in China on it. And those are, again, quality products. Mm-hmm. So what does the effect of this have on the other way trade goes, on the importing to the United States and the price of things we pay from China?
Yeah. These costs, they're going to get born somewhere. So, you know, they'll be born by us and us here. There's a lot of retaliatory and other components that come with it. But, you know, the products that are made globally in the North Dakota products, we say and our members are very adamant about it, we'll compete with anyone with our quality and our word. But you put any kind of barrier in between, then you have a different challenge. But for us, you know, the products that's going back and forth from here, it's really it's one that's the cost of tariffs get borne by somebody. And it's either going to be in the U.S. With some of our people, or it's going to be in China. And therefore, they're going to ask for more, and it's going to be a little more expensive for our exporters to get into that business.
Well, another cost of doing business is getting over there and actually meeting somebody, creating that relationship. There's something called Step ND that you help administer. What is that?
Yeah, well, Step ND is a program that's administered. We administer it through the North Dakota Trade Office, and it's a program that we receive grants and funding from the Small Business Administration, the federal organization. And it's really there to facilitate our companies and our businesses and helping facilitate small businesses in North Dakota to help push their products really to the rest of the world. So it could be in a trade mission, for example, in the trade office. That's one of our specialties as we really help coordinate with our federal partners and researching. We'll do trade missions where we'll take specific companies overseas. But again, there's a lot of process that goes into those. But this is the funding that will help some of those companies pay for their travel, pay for some of their websites and translation services. These costs that for a small company might be a little bit burdensome, for us, it helps facilitate it.
Simon Wilson is the executive director of the North Dakota Trade Office. Thanks for being with us, Simon. We look forward to talking with you in the near future as these things develop.
Thanks, Doug. Look forward to it.
What's happening is next.
When I come back to them, I may be fonder and prouder than ever of my little women.
Joe, Meg, Beth, and Amy, iconic names in American literature. They are the March Sisters of Concord, Massachusetts, created by Louisa May Alcott in her timeless novel, Little Women.
Four small children is a recipe for heartache, headache, and indigestion.
A new masterpiece BBC television production will premiere on Prairie Public in May, but you can get a sneak peek at special one-hour premiere screenings on Sunday, April 29th at 2 p.m. at the Prairie Public Studio in Fargo and at the North Dakota Heritage Center in Bismarck. The event is free and open to the public, but please do let us know you'll be attending by registering at prairiepublic.org.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, nobody asks that question better than Marvin Gaye, and Ashley Thornburg and I struggle with this list every Thursday, which we want to share with our listeners about, you know, what's coming up, to things to do this weekend. And Ashley, what have you got?
Here's a really fun one, the International Wood Arts Festival. This is April 13th through the 15th in Fargo at the Ramada Inn. This gets going noon to 5 on the 14th and 15th. On the 15th, it is noon to 4. This is sponsored by the Red River Valley Wood Carvers. So this is people who are still very active in the wood arts. And some of the sculptures in the brochure that I'm looking at are absolutely amazing, very lifelike. These are some very skilled woodworkers. And you can come and check out them at work. There is going to be even classes that are going to be given starting as early as Friday, April 13th, beginning at 9 a.m. And again, this goes Saturday and Sunday, demos throughout the day. This is at the Ramada Inn all weekend long in Fargo.
The Midwest Folk Fest is Saturday in Devil's Lake at Bethel Church. The Arts Council of the Lake Region presents a Midwest Folk Fest public performance of mesmerizing vocal harmonies and fresh melodies played on the Finnish national instrument by a Finn. Again, it takes place Saturday, April 14th at 2 at Bethel Church in Devil's Lake. There will be a free will offering.
Word Songs, bringing poetry to life this Tuesday, the 17th in Sydney, Montana at the Mondack Heritage Center. This is Dave Casirio, and his poetry is going to be performed here in a dramatic, high-energy, interactive sort of performance here that is also combined with music. Lots of different genres here. There's going to be jazz and blues, classical and folk traditions. Tuesday, April 17th in Sydney, Montana at the Mondack Heritage Center. This gets going at 7 o'clock Mountain Time, and it's free.
The 12th Annual Country Gospel Concert is Friday in Fargo at Messiah Lutheran Church. It stars Merrill Pepcorn and the Radio Stars Band, featuring Loy Larson on fiddle, Greg Smokey Temple on guitar and steel guitar, Bill Law on bass guitar, Don Newstead on drums, and several guest singers, as well as other surprises. Lots of familiar names there. It's 7 o'clock Friday evening at Messiah Lutheran Church in Fargo, and there will be a free will offering.
The Northwest Arts Center, grand opening next week, Thursday, April 19th in Minot at the Northwest Arts Center. This is part of the Walter Peel Gallery dedication. Gets going at 9:30 a.m. at the Elshire Theater on the campus of Minot State University. At 9:30 in the morning, there is going to be a performance by Keith Baer and artists here talking about poetry, musicians, different kinds of art that is going to be available at this. Again, it gets going at 9:30 in the morning, and it is free.
Well, let's celebrate the 90th year of the Richland County Courthouse. That's Richland County in Sydney, Montana, and it will take place at the Mondack Heritage Center. You're invited to join them for celebrating the 90th year of the Richland County Courthouse. See the unveiling of a 7,000-piece Lego brick mini-figure scale model of the exterior of that courthouse. Enjoy conversation, light refreshments, and viewing of the scale model. It's from 2 to 4 on Saturday afternoon, again at the Mondack Heritage Center in Sydney, Montana, and it's free.
Bismarck's Earth Day Festival a week from today, Thursday the 19th in Bismarck at the Career Academy. Fun activities for kids, including face painting, balloon animals, a family scavenger hunt, door prizes. You can even get a free tree that hopefully it will be nice enough to plant. Bismarck Earth Day Festival, April 19th at the Career Academy, 4 to 7:30 p.m. And of course, it's free.
Very grand finale symphony concert is taking place Saturday and Sunday in Fargo at NDSU's Festival Concert Hall. It's one of the most beloved pieces in all, Sergei Rachmaninoff's luscious piano concerto number 2, and the very grand finale of the season for the orchestra. The concert will open with the world premiere of a commissioned piece by Dr. Dan Breeden, professor of composition at Concordia College. And leaving you on a high note until next season will be the final piece of the concert, Ottorino Respeghi's spectacular Roman festivals. So, a big show at the Festival Concert Hall Saturday and Sunday. The hours are 7:30 Saturday, 2 p.m. Sunday. Tickets are $14.38. What's your pick this week?
It is the Pembina Gorge Foundation open house of the Frostfire Ski Resort and Amphitheater. And yes, I did just say ski resort, but that's, you know, it's wintertime activities. In the summertime, there's a lot going on there, too. Wednesday, April 18th, as they are doing an open house. This is recently taken over by the state, 2 to 6:30 p.m. From skiing to fossil digs, the richness of the Pembina River Gorge has a lot of stuff that you can do. So check that out in Wahala, 2 to 6:30 p.m. at Frostfire, and it's free.
And mine is the FM Visual Artists Annual Big Show. Opens today, runs until mid-June. There will be a reception on Tuesday. And, of course, the Big Show is in Moorhead at the Imcombe Center. Lots of art by lots of artists. It is, after all, a big show. The pieces come from art educators, emerging artists, and established artists, and together offers one of the most comprehensive and, again, biggest local art shows in the region. It'll be at the Fourth Floor Gallery at the Imcombe Center. Regular gallery hours for that. The Tuesday reception is from 5 to 8 p.m., and that Tuesday reception is free and open to the public. That's what's happening.
Oh, too much happened. I'm sliding the world. Too much happened.
plight of missing and murdered Indigenous women too often goes unnoticed.
Native people deserve the same support and attention that every other demographic gets.
I'm independent producer Meg Luther Lindholm, inviting you to join me for this week's Prairie Public Presents. The program is Testimonies, which brings people with similar life experiences and challenges together to talk about them.
I get out there and I couldn't believe there's no help. There's no one. There's a half a dozen people. And I thought, that's all she's worth?
On Testimonies, Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, 4 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 12th. North Dakota remembers World War I. April 6th, 1918, marked the one-year anniversary of America's entrance into the Great War. In many of North Dakota's towns and cities, impressive celebrations were held to recognize the dedicated, patriotic effort that had engulfed the state over the past 12 months. Despite a drizzling rain, Bismarck's parade encompassed every organization directly involved in the war, including the Red Cross and the YMCA. Approximately 100 miners from Wilton, representing the United Mine Workers Union, marched behind a sign that stated, "Keep the home fires burning with lignite." In Dickinson, over 1,000 people marched in a parade, including the Home Guard and the Ladies' Auxiliary, known as the Bloomer Brigade. Liberty Day, as it was called, was also the launch day of the third Liberty Loan in an attempt to raise a minimum of $3 billion for the war effort. Although there had been bond issues before, this bond drive was different in that now there was American blood being spilled on the battlefields of France. It took men and money to win the war and bring the boys home. So across the state, it was not a matter of attempting to raise money. It was a race to see who could fill their quota first. To provide Americans with a clearer understanding of the battlefields in France, the Federal Reserve conceived the idea of touring 34 trophy trains. Each unit would consist of two flat cars to display machine guns, cannons, and other heavy ordnance, a coach car to display smaller artifacts and documents, and a sleeper car to provide lodging for soldiers, veterans of the front lines, who explained the exhibits. Melvin Gilmore, curator of collections for the State Historical Society, had conceived a similar idea. Gilmore amassed an array of artifacts from the war zone to exhibit in the Historical Museum in the basement of the Capitol Building. Notable among these artifacts was a collection from Lieutenant Sidney G. Mason from Buffalo, North Dakota, who was an ambulance driver on the battlefields. The artifacts consisted of a French helmet, as well as gas masks, ammunition belts, and cartridge clips from both sides, and a belt for an aerial machine gun. There was also a French signal pistol used to shoot flares at the start of an attack, sending men over the top. Gilmore's collection also included many war posters and documents. It was an impressive and very popular exhibit. Many of these artifacts are currently on display at the North Dakota Heritage Center. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jim Davis. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Friday on Main Street, we'll share an excerpt from this week's Prairie Pulse television show. Host John Harris visits with Tom Gerhardt, Communications Director for North Dakota United. Gerhardt will discuss the interesting developments he's discovered while producing the Cutting Edge podcast. You've heard several excerpts on our Main Street show. And Madeline will review Chappaquiddick tomorrow. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.